I don't know if this is a dubious honor or what it is to do counseling wives whose husband refused to lead. This is a tough cookie to crack. We're like an hour after lunch, and so some of you are getting settled in. I teach a seminary, and I teach both in an undergrad occasionally, too, and so I'm used to people occasionally dozing off. That's fine. It's not a problem. If you get sleepy, feel free to stand up. It's not going to bother anybody if you need to move some. There's no reason to sit there miserable. I've been there many, many, many times. And one of the funniest stories of this speaking on the road all the time was actually happened at this church. It was back in 2000, whenever we were here last. And I did a plenary session in the main auditorium and had been up very early. Of course, when you're from the East Coast, you already just kind of get your sleep awake times goofed up. And so I had spoken for about an hour that morning. Seems like there's something that happened, not much. And then Dave Pallison was doing the plenary session. And Dave and I had stayed up during the night, and we had prayed together and talked. And so I was excited to hear his talk and looking forward to it. And I was sitting right beside Martha Peace and Stuart Scott. We were all in the front row. And I had finished my talk and sat down, and I felt my phone buzzing. And so I looked at it, and it was a text message from Stuart Scott, and it was me sound asleep on the on the front row. So if you need to sleep, that's okay. I get it. I'll assume you're also from the East Coast, and it has nothing to do with me. It's not a big deal. Man, I hope you've had a great day and great weekend. Engage with the speakers earlier, I just think you've probably heard some great stuff. Grateful for God's grace and for the opportunity we have to be together. So today, this afternoon, we're talking about counseling wives whose husbands won't lead. Maybe you know someone like this, where a wife entreats and entreats and entreats her husband. You know, at some point in time, she's just basically begging him to do something, right? Will you lead? Will you help with the kids' devotions? And just the question after question. And somewhere along the way, he begins talking about, you know, it seems like she nags and contentious, and it just goes downhill from there, right? It's a hard conversation. And the lady often can be exasperated. You know, I married this guy. I've known girls. I remember one girl who came to counseling, and she was at her wit's end. She had married this guy thinking that he was going into a particular vocational ministry. Married him in a Bible college. And once they were married, he basically admitted that he knew that she wanted to marry somebody going into vocational ministry. And so he said that he was going to go into vocational ministry, but that was not his plan to go into vocational ministry. This is a couple years into marriage, and she came to me and just simply said, I don't know, we're not friends even. You know, he doesn't lead. I wanted someone who's going to take me into ministry, and I don't even know if I can trust him at all. And talk to him, and he's just kind of blah, right? There's just nothing there. Just no desire seemingly to lead at all. And how do you help this dear girl? Right, there's a sense in which, right, you want to say, dismiss her and say to him, hey, let's go out back. We'll get the deacons together. Baptist ecclesiology, the pastors can stay out of the fray. Right, we'll just handle this, right? We can't do that. But certainly there are times you think, what will it take to get this guy moving? And so she's here and she desires something. This one case, a couple sent in their PDI forms. And so on the PDI forms, of course, you have those diagnostic questions at the back of it. And so it says, what issue are you struggling with that you are coming here for help, or for which you're coming here to help? And so, you know, most of those, you don't have to look but 1 second and you know which one is the man's and which one is the female's, right? I've seen hundreds of them at this point. And if you're a counselor, you probably have two. And so usually, you know, you have a couple inches of white space. And so on one of them, I'll let you guess which is which. On one of them, every bit of it is used. And then an arrow, and then you flip the page over and most of that's used, right? It's just very, very, very verbose. And the other one may say something like, help us in our communication, right? So you can guess which is which on how that works. This particular couple, one of them did say something like, you can help us on communication. But the other, actually the ladies, hers said, I'm 38 and he's 12. Well, that was all. That said, why are you coming? That was the extent of it. His said, we can't communicate in conflict. Can you help us with conflict? So in the session, this actually wasn't my counselee. It's a good friend of mine. And so in the session, he walked in and they walked in together. And so they sat down and they started talking. And he looked at it and he said to the guy, he said, hey, do you know what your wife wrote? And he said, no. He said, well, I'll tell you. He wrote, she's 38 and you're 12. And he said, I didn't know if he'd get upset. I didn't know if he would get frustrated. I didn't know what would happen. And so he sat there for just a second or two and he just started saying, ha, 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 she's right. And he said, at that point, I didn't even know what to do. Right? Right, you can't call him a loser. I don't know, right? What do you say next? Let me set up our time together with this particular case study. I'll read it to you. It says, when they married, Joe and Susan thought this would be the perfect marriage. They were young. She was an aggressive woman, and he was a passive, laid-back, quiet, and calming young man. They both were very attractive and attracted to each other, just like often when opposites tend to do. After all their friends thought that this would be the hitch of the century. So after three premarital sessions, they got married. So it was a quick premarriage. It's not very long before they both started rubbing each other the wrong way. In their words, the first month was really bad. Susan is trying to love him and support him, but he has no initiative to do much of anything. Susan became very anxious when she became pregnant and wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. Joe wanted her to take maternity leave and then go back to work. Joe repeatedly told her that she has the better-paying job with benefits, and he was trying to get his own business up and running, which typically means what? There's very little money. maybe he doesn't work. He won't really pursue other employment because he's never really liked working for people. He tells her he doesn't like people telling him what to do, and he wants to be a self-made man like his dad. Well, both Susan and Joe are professing Christians. They attend Sunday church, but no other involvement past that, according to their information. Most of their friends are all unsaved. Well, after Karen is born, that's their daughter, Susan goes back to work, and a year and a half later, she's pregnant again. And in her words, I've had it with Joe. She begins to push the topic of him getting a real job and showing some leadership around the house. What Susan was not ready for was Joe's settled indignation that has now become more overt, such to the place where she had to call the police due to his sudden outburst of anger and pushing her around. He tells her he can't handle all the pressure and that she is good at decision making and he is not. So Joe says some of the most hurtful things to Susan, like, I wish I would have never married you. My parents never did like you. I could have had the best and I settled for you. And other vulgar stuff not worth mentioning. So Susan is crushed with all of this. She calls the church and asks for counseling. She says, "All I really want is for Joe to get a real job and start leading in our home." Joe tells Susan, "I'll try counseling, but no one at the church is going to tell me what to do." FYI, just a few pieces. Joe's not been going to church for months. Susan found all kind of pornography on the computer and confronted him about it. He says she does not satisfy him any longer and justifies his behavior and withdrawals, so they sleep in different rooms. He also smokes quite a bit of weed while he works in order to chill out from all the pressure. On the phone, she asks, "If he refuses to get help, do I have grounds for divorce?" So the question is, how can we present practical love and care for these people? Right, what can we do for Joe and Susan in this particular scenario? So it really does perplex us at times in terms of what exactly are we going to do with a man and a woman when it comes to counseling wives whose husbands refuse to lead. Just all around general lazy people, maybe, for lack of better words. So as we get started, let me just review. I know you're in track four, so let me just, for the sake of us having said it, let me review the roles of the husband and wife in terms of the way they typically are, close to the way they're typically tracked. You get them in track one. So the husband, his goal is glorifying and submissive, is to be glorifying and submissive to God. The husband is, I should say, glorifying and submissive to God when he is a sacrificial lover. Right? We typically would take guys to Ephesians chapter 5 to think through the necessity of loving his wife, specifically in verses 25 to 33. He loves his wife like Christ loves the church. He is to be a servant leader. Right? 1 Corinthians 11, verse 3. When we think about being a servant leader. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a woman is, the head of a woman is man. And the head of Christ is God. And so his responsibility is to lead his wife. We add the word servant because, like Christ, he serves and leads in that way. He is to be a long sufferer with his wife. Right, his responsibility is to not be harsh or embittered against her. In Colossians 3:19, it says, "Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them." And he is to be a learner of his wife. That's 1 Peter 3, verse 7, that says, "Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, as being heirs together the grace of this life, that your prayers may not be hindered." So, husbands, dwell with them with understanding. That's a learner. Right? So, and I'm just reviewing those with you generally because we want to think carefully about roles, for sure, when we think in these situations. But it's important for you also to know, what exactly does God expect of this husband? If we want him to lead, where is he supposed to lead her to? What is he supposed to be doing? Well, it's just four simple ideas of a sacrificial lover, a servant leader, a long sufferer, and a learner. So all of them with an L, that makes it easy. So what's the wife supposed to do? Well, the wife is glorifying and submissive to God when she is obeying her husband's leadership. Now, you'll recall Ephesians 5, several places, verses 22 to 24, of course. Would be one place where her responsibility. It says, "Wife, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband's head of the wife is Christ, is head of the church, and he is Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, So let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. So the idea is the husband and wife are both equals in personhood. And what do I mean by equals in personhood? They are both in the image of God. They both are created. In fact, most husbands marry up. So we ladies, we do understand that. So usually a wife is smarter, much more organized. A lot of wives, if the husband was responsible for everything a wife was responsible for, the house would fall apart. But it's wives are remarkable in terms of what they handle. Husbands don't say it often enough. A lot of wives are smarter, generally, catch on to what's going on quicker, are more engaged in the home. All of those things are true, but that doesn't make the wife the head of the home. Right? God has chosen for the husband, similar to Christ as head of the church, the husband's the head of the wife. And because of that, in verse 24, the wife is to be subject to her husband in everything. Sometimes I tease the girls that I do counseling with. I do a lot of premarriage, and I'll read that verse 24. I'll say, therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything except those things they're very passionate about and don't care to do. And they usually look at me like, oh, I hope that's true, right? Please tell me that's true. Lots of confusion. I think the best way to explain that in terms of what does submission look like in a home is to understand that although you're equal in essence, you're equal in personhood, you're equal in image, there's a difference in role and function, right? God has defined that differently. It's the position, the way authority goes in the home, the direction of authority. And for the wife, there's a lot of confusion. For sure. I would say young girls, what I typically ask at the end of premarital counseling, after we've spent about 13 weeks together, I typically say, well, tell me an area where you learn the most. And almost without exception, girls almost always say, I did not understand submission. So for sure, it's an area that we want to talk carefully through. And so she's to be obeying her husband's leadership. In many ways, let me just give you one quick example. You could refer to the military. When I had a good friend that when he was heading to Vietnam, he flew over. He was a lieutenant, just graduated out of the leadership course, whatever it was at that point. It's the officer school. So he's heading over to Vietnam. Well, they landed him in Hawaii first, and his uncle was in Hawaii, had been stationed there, and his uncle had been in the Korean conflict and had stayed active and has had a very nice rank. And so he had an opportunity to see his uncle before he went on over to Vietnam to start his job as, I think, if I remember right, he was a lieutenant. And so as he headed over, the uncle said to him, he said, now, son, I'm going to give you some advice, and this advice will keep you alive, and it'll keep all your men alive. So at that point, he's like, okay, this is something I need to hear, especially this guy's been in it for a while. And he said, find your E9. Now you say, what's an E9? Well, an officer is above all the enlisted people, and enlisted people are ranked from E1 to E9. An E9 is somebody typically that's been in the service for 16, 18 years in that range, sometimes maybe sooner, but usually it's a while. So they're very experienced, and they've seen a lot. Well, that E9 is the highest they'll get in enlisted because they can't be an officer. And so at that point, they've got as much authority as they're going to have, and they know the enlisted people. They know them well. They know the way they live. They know what they need to do. They know everything about the life of an enlisted person. So he says, go and find your E9. Why? Because he's this brand new lieutenant with no experience. He says, find your E9, and whatever he says to do, you do that, and you will be fine. Now, what was he talking about? Well, that E9 at the role and function level is lower in a different role and function in terms of submission than the lieutenant. And this uncle is saying, hey, you would be wise, son, to listen well. Because you may have the rank, you may have the job, you may have the role, but this E9 is going to serve you well. Well, in a home, I think it's very, very similar. Right? The husband has the rank. The husband has the role God's given him. But the wife typically, again, is much better with all the other enlisted ones. Right? And understands life. Right? When I go home, I can get off. If I'm at school teaching, by the time I drive to Ozark, which is just north of Branson, I may have 10 ideas. Right? Let's go to the lake. Let's go. I mean, lakes are everywhere in southwest Missouri. Let's go to the lake. Let's go to the forest. We just live on the edge of Mark Twain National Forest. Let's go do whatever. I've got all these things. And by the time I get home, I go to my wife and say, hey, I was thinking maybe we ought to do this. And she may have 22 good reasons that although it's a good idea, it would be a really lousy idea today. Now what? I could say, no, let's do what I want to do. And my gracious wife is probably going to say, that's fine. But I'm a wise husband if I say, I recognize you have much more command of all this than I do. But she still is responsible to obey. Or does that make sense? I think it's a good example to help counselees understand the way the authority functions. And so obey, that's the first one. What else? She has to honor her husband. Ephesians 5:33 helps us with that. It says, nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. The word respects in verse 33 is actually the same word for fear as in fearing God. It's respecting her husband's position. It'd be similar to, right, and for this, isn't this true for like the last several presidents, but you may not appreciate the president, right, depending on which one you like or didn't like, or all of them, whatever. But the role they have, it requires respect. Right? The Bible's clear about that in 1 Peter and other places. So we respect the role even if the person in the role isn't the most respectable. And so what the text says is the wife needs to see that she respects her husband. Now, and we're going to get to the rest of it. We will get through all of our notes. I'm just setting it up. This is review for you from other tracks. So have you ever wonder why he ended in verse 33 with husbands, love your wife, wife, respect your husband? If you want to just jot in your Bible there or somewhere on your notes, Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, it says, during the curse of sin, Adam and Eve have sinned, Satan has received his curse. Now God is talking to the woman, and he says in verse 16, your desire shall be for your husband. Now, that for in Hebrew, it actually means for or against. The context tells us which one of those prepositions to use. Now, dating all the way back to the ASV and KJV, so for the last 100 or so years, more than 100, I guess, if you think KJV, 1901's ASV, for has been the preposition. However, in the Hebrew, I would make the argument, especially in light of chapter 4, as that's used in the exact same scenario there, but in chapter 4 it's used with Satan, but everything else is similar. I would suggest that the preposition ought to be against her husband, not for her husband. If wives aren't walking around in the sin nature, which is what he's talking about, right? This is our sin DNA. Wives are not walking around saying, whoo, how can I serve him today? This is wonderful, right? I am for him. She doesn't stand at the door, right? Maybe they did on Father's Knows Best or Leave It to Beaver. Maybe that happened, June Cleaver. But on the average home, wives aren't standing at the door saying, I just can't wait to serve this guy. And hopefully we can have sex the rest of the afternoon. And Right? There's just, that's not reality. Instead, what's reality? A wife is often against her husband. The authority he has is authority that she isn't very excited to follow and would like to have herself. So it's an authority issue. And then notice in that same passage, it says, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. The rule in that text is a force rule. So in Adam, what two things happen? In Adam, the wife is trying to usurp the authority of her husband. And the husband, you know, like that game where those things pop up, my kids play it, and you're always trying to bat them down, see how many you can bat down. Right? The husband is forcefully trying to keep her in her place. Sometimes, though, abdicating his role, but still, I would suggest that's sinfully abdication, trying to get what he wants out of the marriage. That's in Adam. Well, what's the context of Ephesians 5? So go back to Ephesians 5. The context of Ephesians 5, if you'll look in verse 18, actually look at verse 15, the command is to walk circumspectly. That means be careful how you walk, be careful how you live. The next command then in 18 is be filled with the Spirit. From verses 18, then 19, 20, and 21, you have five participles, just a bit of an English lesson. Those five participles are called participles of result, which means if you are filled with the Spirit, these are the five things you're going to do. What are those things? Speaking, singing, they have ings if you haven't figured it out, making melody, giving thanks, and the fifth one is submitting to one another in the fear of God. Now, what does that mean to submit to one another in the fear of God? It means that you submit to the role that God's placed you in. So when you get down to verse 33, does it surprise us then that he ends this with saying, in the Spirit, the wife, instead of trying to usurp authority, she's going to what? Respect her husband. And in the Spirit, instead of a husband trying to forcefully rule his wife, the husband is going to love his wife. Right? So this is the in the Spirit fix on the sin DNA in every person out of Genesis. And so when we get to this particular portion, when it says a wife should honor her husband, that's in the Spirit living. I honor the role that God's given him. What else? How about helping her husband? Right? The idea is in Genesis, she was given to Adam as a helper, which is a great role for two reasons. One, it demonstrates he's not complete without her. The second good reason is because God, this word is used a lot more times about God than it's used about a woman. And it says in many of those instances, God is our helper. Right? So it's not that it is not a word that's less than a gracious word. And so the idea is that a wife helps her husband. Maybe 1 Corinthians 11 and other passages can help fill in the blanks there. And then the last thing I would suggest is home attentive, especially if there's children. So Proverbs 31 and other passages would suggest a wife is a helper of her husband, but is primarily home attentive, even when she has to work in other jobs, which becomes very difficult. So understanding the roles, because if we're going to say, how does a wife help when the husband's not willing to lead, it's important to start with just a simple foundation. Well, what are the roles anyway? Right? What are they supposed to be doing? All right, let's work through then several things. Here's number one. There's always help and hope in light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Right? There's always help and hope in light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. We could fill the page with verses that help us know that. Right? Even just the simplest, the ones that you know off the top of your head, such as 1 Corinthians 10, 13. We know that there's no pressured-filled circumstance. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. But God, what? Is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above which you're able, but with the temptation also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. What's it saying? God's grace is up to the challenge of this husband. God's grace is up to the challenge of this marriage, of this circumstance. So there's always help and hope in light of the gospel. I love Philippians 2 as it describes the power that works in us when it says in verse 13, "For it is God who works in you, both to will and to do for his good pleasure." Right? God is the one that energizes the believers in this home. Ephesians 1 would be very similar. In verses 19 through 23, it describes this exceeding great power toward us who believe according to the working of his mighty power. And then he describes that power, and the very first way he describes it is what? Resurrection power. The power that resurrected Christ out of the grave is the same power that is in the life of every believer in the Spirit. And for those reasons, we have hope in any relationship. What are some biblical mandates and principles? Well, the first, both are to parent and instruct. Right? Both husband and wife have equal responsibility. She can help provide. Right? That's not necessarily what she may want to do in the life of Joe and Susan. For sure, Susan did not. If I end up calling her Joe and Mary, just know that in my brain, the first names aren't the same, of course. And I had Mary jotted down, so I may have my brain all messed up here. So if she's maybe, let's make her Susan Mary. So first or middle name, one or the other. So Joe and Susan, she doesn't want to work, but she can help provide. Right? It is possible and still honor God. She is to obey in everything as unto the Lord except sin. You know, I think it's important for us to know that all authority in the Bible is limited. Right? If the husband says, if Joe says to Susan, "Hey, I will go with you to church. Although they're not going to tell me what to do, I'll still go with you to church to get counseling. But you will not tell them that I smoke pot. And you will not tell them that I've pushed you around." Right? At that point, she can't. That's not a command, that's not a request that she can obey, because he can't say to her to lie. Right? Because his authority, that's not the in the Lord authority that he's given. Right? He directs her as Christ with the church, and as his authority only goes as far as the scriptures would allow. And so anytime he is in opposition to the Bible or into God, then that's where his authority ends, and she has to obey God and not man. And so reality, though, is she's still to obey, except for sin. Both, in this scenario, are to love each other as Christ loves the church. The man is required to love her in some ways with even greater passion, because his is the one that's described in Ephesians 5. Right? It's his, Christ's love and his love are connected. They're side by side, and so you see those things, but we can't miss Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. Right? The wife and the husband both, as believers in Jesus Christ, Ephesians 5, 1 says, "Therefore be imitators of God as dear children and walk in love." We talked about that, I think, in an earlier session today. So the wife is still required to love like Christ loves. Now, it's probably not going to be as difficult on her. That's probably why the husband needed his own new section. However, both are required, right? Both are required to love the church, love the wife, love each other. So both are to love each other as Christ. The man is required to love as Christ loves the church. I think that's a bit of a typo the way that's written. It's very confusing. Next, she is to live with her husband in a gentle and quiet spirit. Right, so as we begin to talk with her, we understand 1 Peter 3. It says, "Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear," which that's our word fear for respect. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Neither let it be the hidden, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Right? So what we understand is that she is to live with a gentle and quiet spirit. And this text in 1 Peter 3 is for a wife with an unbelieving husband. And so the argument would be from the lesser to the greater, from the greater to the lesser, whichever way you want to flip it. Seemingly, it'd be more difficult to do it with an unbelieving husband. So that would be from the greater to the lesser. So, of course, it's what you ought to be doing with the believing husband. So you're to live with the gentle and quiet spirit. So then what are we going to do? Number three, evaluating the marriage family situation. What do you want? You want both perspectives if possible. You want the guy to come and talk with you. You want to hear from the lady, of course. She's the one that you're counseling. Why is it important to hear both perspectives? You can just jot yourself a little note. Often because what we realize is that whoever's holding the camera typically isn't in the picture. Not with the world of selfies, but right until recent, if you're carrying the camera, you're the one that's not in any of the pictures. And so why is that? What's the issue here? The lady sitting in front of you telling the story, if you're not careful, she's not in the picture. She's giving you a story that's one-sided. You're not seeing the entire thing. Stuart Scott tells a hilarious story about a lady who they were having a yard sale at their house, and this lady walked down the street, and so she's pushing twins. They just moved from Michigan or Minnesota, one of those states, and so she's pushing her twins, and she comes up, and Zandra and he are talking to her, and so they meet each other, and what do you do? And they're kind of exchanging pleasantries, and he said, "Well, I'm a pastor." This was before, this was years ago. He said, "I'm a pastor, and I also counsel." And she said, "Oh, you counsel?" He said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, maybe you can help me." And she unbuttons her sleeve and pulls her sleeves up on both sides, and there's bruises on her arms. She said, "Maybe you can talk to my husband. He bruised me." And Stuart was like, he said he looked at Zandra, and she gave him the eye like, "Okay, you need to say yes, you can help, because..." Right, that's checking with the E9. And so she said, "And he's home right now, working outside in the yard on the truck." And Stuart said, "I reluctantly said, all right, I'll go talk to him." And so he goes down this couple houses down to where they live and meets the guy. The guy was right middle of doing his truck. And the guy was very pleasant, big, he said, but pleasant. And so they exchange pleasantries, and so as they talk, he said, "Hey, I met your wife a few minutes ago." And the guy said, "Oh, really?" He said, and Stuart said, "I could just kind of stuttering a little bit, trying, how do I say the next thing?" And the guy says, "Now, she didn't show your arms, did she?" And he said, "Yeah, she did." And he said, "Well, let me tell you how that happened. We were in the kitchen having an argument. And I said to her, 'You're just like your mother.' And she came at me with two butcher knives. And so I took both her hands and pinned her against the wall and held her as tight as I could until she finally dropped those knives." And Stuart said, "Oh, she didn't mention that." Right? Right? One side of the story. So he calls the Proverbs 18 the butcher knife. Psalm, proverb. Proverbs 18:17 and Proverbs 18:13, the steak knife verse of the Bible. So you need both perspectives, right? You're all experienced counselors, so that's not new to you. So what are some questions you can ask as you seek to get both of their perspectives? Well, one question is, what's your definition of lead? Right? If she's saying... And if you remember in Susan's story, Mary Susan or Susan Mary, she said specifically, I just want him to lead. So at that point, we need to figure out what does she mean by lead, right? What is she actually asking us to help her do? What is her goal? What does she imagine is happening? Another question that we're interested in, is it refusal or are there other possible explanations? Right, possibly he has tried to lead her and he's been shot down. So at this point he's given up. Stuff like dad would have when he goes to do something. Or dad never. Or that's not good enough. Or I can't believe you would do it that way. Or every time he starts to do something, he faces criticism. You say, I can't imagine a wife would ever do that. I've ever had a lot of counselees where I've seen that. Husbands come in and they're just worthless. When you listen to their story and you start digging in a little bit and realize there's a reason he's worthless, because he's tired of the criticism. He's about ready to give up. So is it refusal? Is he refusing to lead, or is actually there more going on there? Right? Those are just questions. We don't assume that the wife's doing anything, but we can't also assume that the husband is refusing to lead. Right? So we have to do some good data gathering to figure it out. Possibly he doesn't know where to begin. Possibly it's not refusal. He just has no idea what it means to be a godly husband. Maybe his dad was a very poor role model, or maybe he had no dad. Maybe it was an absentee father, or as you know, single pregnancy is as much as ever, more than ever. And so maybe he had no involvement with a man at all. I remember one guy that my dad helped. My dad's next year he'll retire, I think, is what he's thinking. He's pastored in the same church for 48 years. And so it's his 50th year of ministry, I believe. And I remember for years we had a young man who would come over to our house, and my dad just let him mow the yard. He let him work outside with him. He would take him whenever he had errands to run. He would call and say, hey, you want to go with me? We did activities with them. And it's because this guy had no father in his life at all. And dad recognized by the time he hit teenager, he was saved in his early teens. He understood, you know, if somebody doesn't invest in this kid, this kid's going to struggle the rest of his life. Possibly that's what you're dealing with. Those struggling guys do get married. And usually their marriages struggle as well. And so he maybe doesn't understand what it means to be a spiritual leader. I mean, one guy, I remember, would say, well, I am a spiritual leader. What do you mean? Well, I read, I pray, I do my devotions. In fact, I think he made devotions a verb. He said, I devote. But then when you looked at everything else he did, there was nothing about it that I would say is leadership. His wife had real reasons to complain. The guy didn't even understand what he could do or should do. I think that's, you can just jot down here. One thought that we have at this particular point is there one thing that he could do to begin to become a leader? Right? Is there one thing that would get him moving in the right direction? It may take a while to get him actually to become a good godly leader. We can't expect that overnight, but we can look for one thing. Right? When you say, what's my counseling agenda? How about one thing? Because most guys can handle one thing. Right? If you overwhelm him, he may get embarrassed and then you lose a counselee. Right? So you can go one thing. Most of us can. What else? Well, we want to get to the heart. We don't want to settle just for behavior change. So what are some common lusts with husbands and wives? We're thinking, of course, in James. Well, sometimes it's craving for approval. You know, I just want her, or I just want him happy. Maybe it's craving for peace and comfort, or craving for control. Remember one man that, fascinating, it just seemed like a tale of day and dark, but around church and around his work, he was the most kind, gentle, volunteering person you've ever met. Did it all. And you know, the one way to control in a church is what? Volunteer. Right? Churches will just keep giving you stuff, and you can run it all if you'll just keep volunteering with a big smile. But the wife came and started telling a story of home life where when he would get home, he would expect the whole family to be on the line. And he would talk to him, and he would talk to him almost like a sergeant, a drill sergeant. And they'd have to answer back in specific phrases. And he would say, "I can't hear you." And she'd have to raise her voice louder and go back and forth. And all the clothes in the closet had to be by style and color and in the particular arrangement that he demanded. All the toys had to be picked up by the time he got home so that the house was clean and presentable and the way he demanded it. And you listen to that and you say, how can this be the same guy? Well, it's because it's a lust for control. Right? At home, he can demand control. At work, if he were to do that, he'd be fired. At church, if he were to do that, he wouldn't get control at all. He may get confronted and actually face some form of discipline. So what does he do in those places? He volunteers. It's the same heart that produces both of those actions, and the action is ultimately to get and maintain control. So maybe it's a craving for control, a craving for perfection. I just want it just so. This is the way I want it. Maybe it even is a craving for a godly marriage or a family, and they define that in a very particular way. So those are some common lusts for both husbands and wives. Also, you want to explore expectations. One person said, expectations are premeditated disappointments. That seems fairly wise to me. So what are those expectations? Well, maybe it's, I want you to be just like Dad. Or I want you to be like my brother or like whomever or whatever. And what happens then when those expectations aren't met? And that's the next thing. We want to explore how she responds when her expectations are not met. When those expectations are not met, then we may see anger, bitterness, pride, a poor spirit, maybe any number of things. And so as we're trying to counsel this lady, that's one of the issues that at least we're interested in. Now note, this should include a careful discussion and review of godly communication and resolving conflict, because possibly they are just very much not skilled. And so we want to think through those things carefully. In Women Helping Women, which is a great book by Elise Fitzpatrick, in in page 190, I think Martha Peace has a great discussion starters list in that particular book. All right, so what are available resources then as we seek to counsel this lady? Let me suggest four main resources. First, of course, is God's promises. Right, we want to encourage her with God's promises. Promises that are for his children, like his grace is sufficient in 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and 10. Or promises about his presence. One of the great passages for his presence is the Great Commission in Matthew 28. It says what? And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world or the age. So the presence of Christ is a big deal. In fact, this is something that I've blogged about in the past, but it'd be just a fun study for you to do, or you're welcome to go to the blog. I've got some stuff on it there. If you look at all the places in the Bible where God says specifically, don't be afraid, for I am with you. So he connects being with somebody, his presence, with the idea of being strong and courageous, not being afraid. So his promises of his presence. His indwelling. Right, that's an important promise that we want to remind people of. In Hebrews 13, verse 5. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? It's his indwelling presence. So we want, and there's lots of promises that we could add in there. So what else? Prayer is another one. At least you want to pray for these three things, among other things. But you want to pray for God's glory in the circumstance, right? That needs to be the goal, not a fixed marriage. We want God's glory to be the goal, so pray for that. Pray for the other person's good, right? So as we lead this lady into prayer, we want her to pray for her husband's good. And for the sake of this talk, I'm discussing it as if the husband is saved, because Joe in this scenario said he was. So pray for the growth of the church, as this is a husband and wife, and they're both in the same body of Christ. So Ephesians 4, 11 to 16. So we want to pray. What's another resource? Well, the church is another resource. Right? We want the church. We need her to reach out to the church. The church has oversight of her. Hebrews 13, 17. Right, obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls. We want the church to encompass them around. Right, we want the church to surround them and serve them. So the church may be able to help her, both at a godly lady, as well as we may need men to start working with this particular husband. And then the final resource I think we have is the one and others. Right on page 221 there, you'll see 35 one and others. Now, what do we want to remember here? Well, husband and wife are both brother and sister in Christ. Therefore, all of these one and others are in play in marriage. Right? These are things we're supposed to be doing as a husband and wife. Marriage does not negate any of these one and others. Because before we were married, or even if we got saved after we were married, if that's the case, the reality is we're married. And so in a respectful way, the wife in every one of these has responsibilities as well for her husband. Now, along the way, she may have to ask the church for help, which is one of the resources. She may have to ask for deacons or for men. But love one another. Number 5, welcome one another. 8, deprive not one another. I'm just reading a few. Care for one another's 10. Provoke not in verse 11, or not verse, number 11. Bear burdens in 12. Speak truthfully in 13. Right? He can't ask her not to tell him the truth about his sins. Be kind to one another. 15, forgive when confession is made. 19 is interesting. Colossians 3:13, bear with one another. That means to put up with somebody's non-sinful weirdness. Right, their idiosyncrasies, their various things that you figure out once the salesman's gone and you're married to him. Right, 27, stir up one another. I often tell the girls I do premarriage counseling with, I say, just remember, you're dating the salesman. I hope he's being honest, but that most of the case, you're getting the best he has. What? So to love and stir up one another to love and good deeds. That word means to irritate, to provoke, to irk in a godly way. Right? To stir them up. 35 is fellowship with one another. Right? If you're doing the rest, then fellowship follows. So what's a potential way forward? Let me give you several steps. Here's the first one. Self-counsel. Right, the wife has to initially begin to think about her own heart. So she has to start there. Prayer. We've already talked about the necessity of it, but we're going to invite her to begin praying, and we're going to give her some specific prayer requests. We want her to seek help. Whenever she needs it, we want her to seek help. So we want to give her people in the church that she can talk to, a counselor potentially, since that's what we are. But she needs to, she doesn't need to wait. She needs to have a very sensitive spirit toward when she needs help. We need to get it to her. She needs to practice the one another's. So that may include taking that list and looking at it and picking one a week or two, saying, this is the one I want to move forward on. She needs to clearly communicate to her husband. So from that standpoint, you may have to help her word it for her. Help her word it. Help her put it in words that will be respectful. She needs to give and share. Right? A lot of times when the husband's not leading, it actually encourages her to withdraw. It encourages her to not share and to not give. But in every way, her husband's still supposed to be her best friend. And so with our best friends, we give and we share. We love. Even our enemies, we're supposed to do that in some sense, but for sure with our husbands. We want to help her learn how to make godly appeals. Figure out the timing of those appeals. Figure out the best way to word it, a way that's respectful. We want to get help from the church. Now, I did not make this clear a minute ago, but letter C is to seek help. Right at that point, she needs to be willing to reach out. And then in letter H, we need to get her help from the church. Right? We need, so it's a both and. Possibly could be combined. And then letter I, she needs to show respect and love. One last question, then I want to give you a few notes to counselors. So what if the husband's unsaved? Well, the issue, and I'm just going to leave this here for you to think about, and we'll move on. But the question comes out of 1 Peter 3, and we have to say, what does it mean to be pleased to live with an unbeliever? And so we may have to help her think through, what does that mean? What are the implications of it? I know there are various 6 different views, 5 of them partially biblical. On divorce and remarriage. So those are things for sure we have to think about as we try to help people. All right, some special notes to counselor. First, listen, listen, listen. Show compassion. Now, part of that, and guys, let me just say this to you. You're potentially going to be the counselor. And I think you have to protect her marriage. You have to protect her heart. You have to protect her husband's possession, which is his wife. You have to protect your testimony. You have to protect your integrity. The way you deal with her needs to be full of compassion, but it can't lead her in a way that would draw her away from her husband. You must protect yourself. You need accountability. Because you're there to help her with her husband, and not in any way to distract from that. Again, begin with self-counsel. Help her consider her part of the problems in the marriage. I think Leslie Verdick has a chapter in her book that says, what do my spouse's wrongs reveal in me? That's a great question. Do not neglect to give her, help her, pardon me, take responsibility for her part regardless of what the husband does or does not do. Right, it's not a tit for tat. The gospel points her to Jesus Christ and her relationship with him. He's the perfect husband. Her husband will never match up. At the same time, Jesus provides her everything she needs to respond to a husband who is imperfect. Help her see the value of developing strong relationships in the church. Help her recognize creative ways to serve her husband and to create greater intimacy. She's probably going to need help here. And then try to meet with the couple together as much as possible. That would be my preference, of course. All right, we are out of time. Let me pray for you. I'm going to head over to the chapel to speak to Fundamentals Track. It's been great meeting you. You've been very kind all day. Thank you for your kind attention. Let me pray for you. Lord, we are grateful that you give us the church. We're grateful that you give us each other. Thank you that on my worst day and on every husband's worst day, and when we lead so pitifully, thank you that for the most part you give us wives who are very patient. And certainly they give us better than what we ever deserve. And as our helpmates, as our ones that you've given us as your special gift, no less than Eve to Adam, I pray that we would embrace those as husbands and that we would lead well, that we would seek to live consistent with what you've called us to do. For the wives, especially those ladies that we may be in this room, some, of course, in our counseling, Lord, I pray that you would give them the comfort of your presence, that you would help them have the discernment to love your word and your plan and following your will more than a husband that does everything the right way, that they would depend on your grace, that they would walk with Jesus. And then where we need to, as biblical counselors, may we step up to the plate and appropriately help, and to seek to provide the right guidance. Lord, at times it's going to take us out of our comfort zone. At times it's going to take our personal time and energy. But may we be willing to do those things for the sake of your daughters who need help. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.